So I often think about this as God intentionally having left creation unfinished. He started the process, but then he invites others into that process. He created everything. Then he left it to his image bearers to name the animals. I think God could have named the animals, that he was perfectly capable of naming those animals that he already had created from nothing. But he left that to Adam, a show of dominion over that creation. So it sets us apart as being something other than just an animal. It also makes us not God, but having part of that authority that God has given as his image bearers.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
When you open your Bible to the very first page, you have God calling. The heavens and the earth are created by the word of his mouth. God calls. And the image here is of an ancient Near Eastern monarch, a great king, the emperor over all the kings, who is summoning even the lower kings into his court, into his chamber. That's how God does stuff. He speaks. He calls things into being that didn't exist. And he called us into being and gave us callings, gave us vocations. But a lot of times we don't feel like our quote-unquote job is a calling, is a vocation. Yeah, we believe we've been called to saving faith in Jesus Christ. We believe we've been called to various places in the church, given spiritual gifts to help the body of Christ. But what does it mean on Monday? What does it mean when we go to work? Are we called to that? Is it God calling us? Or is it just the world calling us because we need a job? That's what we're going to be talking about in this series on vocation. I'm here with your usual cast of characters here, Bob Hiller, Lutheran pastor, and Justin Holcomb, who is an Episcopal minister and also teaches at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando. I'm Mike Horton. I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. And we have a special guest with us, Walter Strickland, new friend who is a professor at Southeastern Baptist Seminary and also has written some very interesting books on vocation, has an institute for vocation, and it's one of his specialties, teaches systematic theology and contextual theology at Southeastern Baptist Seminary. Walter, it's great to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here with y'all.
Why don't we get right into it? First of all, what I like about your approach, Walter, and this is in your book, Every Waking Hour, An Introduction to Work and Vocation for Christians, that you wrote with Benjamin T. Quinn, this approach is so important to start out of the gate with, and that's the history of redemption. I mean, we do that for almost any theme, but you hardly ever, when people are talking about work and vocation and theology and work or theology of work, you wonder what they're talking about, because very often it's muddled. It seems like, what are the categories here? What are the distinctions that are kind of muddled together? Is there really attentiveness to the biblical plot line? Why don't we start out of the gate with that work before the fall?
Yeah, I think this is something that when we meet God in the beginning, we see that God is a worker. He is bringing things into existence. He's separating things. He's doing work, which this is actually in a stark contrast to how people would have thought of God in the time period of when the Bible was written. Usually gods are the ones who are served. They don't do the work themselves. You know, there's the image of the deity who's being brought the grapes and fed by his subordinates and, you know, and all that kind of thing. This is exactly what, you know, Moses was trying to upend as he was communicating the beginnings of time to us. This is a good thing because oftentimes we just work for the weekend to pay the bills.
Are you referring to Loverboy?
I was.
Really?
I'm so glad
you're
that
so
somebody,
young. You know, working for the weekend? Wow. All right.
I was about 6 months old. I remember hearing it for the first time.
Just had to do that.
Wow.
To do it.
Yeah. So I think from the beginning of the biblical narrative, it upends that kind of thinking. And so I think that's a very helpful thing for us to see, that work is a good thing.
So don't start with the fall. Start with creation.
Exactly.
It is good. Mm-hmm.
Let's dive into this doctrine of creation, because I think that's what frames how we would be thinking about work. Because the Bible, as you said, Walter, is constantly portraying God as a vigorous worker in the world, not merely the creator, but he's also the redeemer, and he is the quality control manager. He's the judge of works. Like, he's very active. And then you have Jesus in John 5:17, my Father is working until now, and I am working. Like, the language of actual exerting and working is huge here. I love doing this. When you look at Genesis and say, okay, what was Moses doing? Well, he was giving them a positive statement about God, but also doing pastoral apologetics against the surrounding neighbors. In creation texts associated with Israel's neighbors, work was regarded as a dreary burden. Like, it was something we wanted to avoid. And in Mesopotamia, in their creation story, the gods made humans as slaves to provide relief from the labors of running the universe. Like, I don't want to run this universe. If y'all could do this, that would be great. As opposed to God going, he seems to be thrilled with his creation. It's good.
Every stage of it, he stops and he looks at it and he says,
this is,
this is good.
Like, he wants to do more. And then finally, instead of like barely getting to the finish line, and he's like, oh, day six, good grief. He's like, this is good. It's like, it's getting better. And so in Mesopotamia, humans were to help the gods do the running of the universe. In the Egyptian story, treats humans as, quote, cattle of the gods. That was actually the picture. And humans were a pest. So God in the Bible is a working God. Therefore, that should frame how Christians would be thinking about work just from the get-go, of just the God whose image we are made in is a working God, which is different from all the other gods, and invites his humans that are the good creation to join in giving shape to the very thing he made, cultivating the garden, that kind of language.
Yeah, that's interesting. You think about this, here's Moses preaching this to the Israelites who are being dehumanized, and he actually says, you Israelites who are working are actually performing a more divine duty than Pharaoh who sits above you and enslaves you and all this sort of thing. And it actually doesn't make what the situation they're in is good, but it does give dignity to work, and it associates it with the gods more than those who don't work. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and I think the points that you all are making are so important to contextualize this. We can read Genesis 1 and 2 thinking Moses was put in a deep sleep and somehow, you know, remembered or was given the notes on the Big Bang. Basically, a cosmology without any context. No, the context is, my God can beat up your God. Yahweh is not a territorial God. Here's Egypt, the largest empire in the world at the time, oppressing Israel. And he's just laughing through the whole thing. He's saying, this is, no, what I did in Egypt when I slew all of the gods of Egypt right before your eyes, here I'm creating them. Yahweh is the creator of all of the gods, quote unquote, of Egypt. They're not gods, they're creations. And then he gets to the creation that is very good. The superlative is added, not just good, very good. He made man and woman in his image. In his image, he made them. They're both image bearers. They're both given the vocation we'll talk about in a second. In this context, image of God doesn't mean something within us, Plato and, you know, this immortal soul that's divine inside of me. It is a role, a royal status. The son of the Pharaoh was called the image of the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh was called the image of Ra, the sun king, the great king. Now you have everything being creation, creature, no gods, but Yahweh, and this creature, humanity, not made to do the dirty work for the gods. This creature made the royal sun.
To reflect God. Nothing else in all creation reflects the glory of God like humans do. What does God do in creation? Now, again, we talked about science and faith, and we went through Genesis, but regardless of your view of how God creates, what you know from the text is in day 1, 2, and 3, he creates the domains, the areas. In days 4, 5, and 6, he fills those days. So day 1, domain is filled by day 4, creation. Day 2, domain is filled by day 5, things that are in that domain. And day 3 and day 6, likewise. So what you have there already is the domain that is being filled. Put your finger on that one, just put a pin in that one, because then when he makes humans, he says, you know, multiply and have dominion. which is exactly what he did.
And filled the earth.
He, he made this domain, and then he multiplied it. So the call to humans of multiply and have dominion, that's a broad calling that all humans have before the fall. Mm-hmm. So it's important to show that the whole scope of human work existed before the fall, and that the work in and of itself is not the effect of a curse. Work is curse, but work is not a curse. That's mm-hmm. really important just to say, because mm-hmm. we're not dualists. And Genesis 1 shows that the whole scope of human work existed before Genesis 3. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've kept on saying we don't start our theology with Genesis 3. We start with Genesis 1 and 2, which means that work is not a curse and all kinds of work are good.
And think about what this means, like how the doctrine of vocation comes in here now, because God, if he had wanted, could have continued to make people from the earth. He could have continued to speak the creation into existence just like he did that first week. But instead now, he's doing it through people. He's having the earth filled and populated through mothers and fathers. He's
let the earth bring forth.
That's right.
Not let there be, but let the earth bring
That's right.
forth.
So now the work is being done. It's still God doing it, but now God is doing it through means, through the people that he has created.
So I often think about this as God intentionally having left creation unfinished. He started the process, but then he invites others, his vice regents, into that process. He created everything. Then he left it to his image bearers to name the animals. I think God could have named the animals, that he was perfectly capable of naming those animals that he already had created from nothing.
He's pretty good with words.
Exactly. But he left that to Adam.
It's a royal function.
Exactly. Mm. A show of dominion over that creation. So it sets us apart as being something other than just an animal. It also makes us not God, but having part of that authority that God has given as his image bearers. And then as we think about that, I often think about, okay, well, what are we working with? What are we fashioning? And I think about it in the sense of material and immaterial creation. Material creation is what we often think about as forming something. We have those who work out of raw materials that we can touch and feel, making iron into a building, making concrete into sidewalks and things like that. But there's also immaterial creation. Like as teachers, you're creating a curriculum. You can't really see it. It's just this process through which students are walking through and then maturing them in an area of thought. And even as Christians, even maturing them spiritually. For those who are entrepreneurs, creating structures and systems and practices, those things are things that we ought to see to as well. So as his vice regents, we should see over those things that are material and also things that are immaterial. And I think those are very helpful sort of categories to understand how we're continuing the work of God's creation that he left strategically unfinished so we can do that work with
him. That's a great point.
And what's cool is that, I love this, because God created with words. It's powerful, but when we do our work as vice regents, it takes time and energy and exertion. So it highlights the creator-creation distinction at the same time that you have this royal imaging and royal call to name the animals. There's also this humility and the difference between us and the God that we image.
We're also in a position of faith or reception through this whole thing too. Like all the creating we're doing is secondary. We're receiving the gifts from God and then using those gifts to share with others. And this is where vocation becomes a sort of avenue of love for us, that the things I build, if I build a structure, I'm not just building it to create something for my own pleasure. I'm building a structure so someone can work or live or have a place to be. So God gives us the materials. We receive them with open hands, and then we share them with open hands with others. And in this way, God is working through us to continue to sustain the creation.
So my neighbor is not a burden, but a gift.
A gift, right.
You know, I'm so interested in categories, but I think they do help us to think through the difference between creation before the fall and after the fall. We talk about cult and culture. Cult just not meaning Jehovah's Witnesses. Cult meaning worship, the kingdom of God, the priestly function of humanity, and then culture as you're 9 to 5, going out there and creating great works of art or sweeping the floor to the glory of God. Whatever you do to the glory of God, that's honoring, but it's cultural labor. I mean, we can talk about how it gets distinguished after the fall in a sec, but here in creation, there is no distinction between cult and culture. There is no distinction between church and state. There's no distinction between sacred and secular. The kingdom of God is Adam and Eve going to work on Monday. And what are they doing? They're prophets. Again, in all of this, they're imaging God. They're not God. They're not original. It's not coming from them, but from God through them. They're imaging God as prophets, reinterpreting his word and proclaiming it to the animals, as it were, and the rest of creation. They're priests who are mediating between God and the creation below human beings. They are bringing the thank offering to God. They are leading. You know, Adam is supposed to lead as the covenant head of the human race, supposed to lead creation in a parade before the great king. And then king. We've been talking about the adopted son, royal son, both male and female, of Yahweh himself, the creator of it all, prophet, priest, and king. And that's what's so tragic about the fall. You know, he just becomes this false prophet, this horrible priest, and a king who gets caught with his hand in the till.
If you're enjoying this conversation about work and faith, you'll want to get a copy of Every Waking Hour by our guest for this series, Dr. Walter Strickland. For a donation of any amount, we'll send you Dr. Strickland's book. You can request this resource by going to whitehorsein.org/offers. That's whitehorsein.org/offers.
Before we move to the fall, I would love to hear some thoughts about how Sabbath works into this, because I think that's frequently overlooked. We go from before the fall and then fall, but there's this Genesis 2:23, and on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done. He rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. I mean, usually I read that, I pay attention to the seventh day and Sabbath, but because of this conversation, the word work is jumping out from this. I would love to hear any, you know, insights on how, before we get to fall stuff, how does Sabbath fit into this conversation?
So in a practical way, I think Sabbath is, it's obviously important for us, but some of the things that we do in Sabbath is that we realign our understanding of work to be in line with the Creator's sort of understanding of it. The idea of glorifying God by making ourselves useful to others. Throughout the grind of the week, especially in a very materialistic society, our rationale for working can be very self-centered and self-focused. So on that seventh day, we reconnect with the giver of life, the author of creation, the one who has actually given us this covenant to work, and then we begin to refocus on him, therefore better understanding ourselves as workers. And I also think in a very practical way, we express other parts of our humanity that we don't get to exercise in our work. You know, this is why the construction worker who's lifting heavy things and very burly and brawny can, you know, relax by playing his violin or playing a piano. You know, he's working with his hands, so now he's resting with his mind. And then we have the person who, like myself, as a teacher, a theology professor, I'm thinking, I'm teaching, I'm writing, I'm preaching and things like that. So I like to rest by working in my yard. So on Saturday, I noticed as I was just cutting my grass before preaching on Sunday, I always end up doing a lot of yard work before I preach because I'm expressing a different part of my humanity than I normally would in my work. And so I think that's a very important thing for us, lest we dehumanize ourselves into a commodity. And this is even with people who are teachers, the language is today, hey, you're a great resource. So it's actually, no, I'm a person. And I'm a person who I do dedicate myself to a lot of reading and study and things like that, but I also have emotions. We also have, you know, other things we do as well, you know, to be fully human the way God intended. So our theological anthropology begins to sort of be a part of this conversation as well. So I think as far as Sabbathing, like resting, what does it do? It reacquaints our understanding of work with the Creator's understanding of work, loving God and serving neighbor, but also it allows us to do things that we normally don't get to do in our 9-to-5.
So you're telling me my wife is correct when she says to me on Saturday, it's time to do yard work. Like this is, she's being more faithful than I am, saying I need to watch college football. That's probably correct.
Well, I would never go against college football. However, there's a both and, you know.
There's a both and.
So I'd certainly say that, you know, if you are someone who is pastoring, you're shepherding and things like that, you know, the yard work has its place,
certainly does.
And we even see that physically in our physical bodies, it demonstrates if we just, you know, have a job that's, you know, as a minister teacher, and then we just sit around and eat all weekend, our physical bodies will pay a price for that as well.
And it's actually, I mean, I'm joking about it, but when I get a project done with my hands at home, it's phenomenal because as a pastor, or even as a teacher, I'm sure, you're doing something and the tangible result isn't always there. But if I dig a hole in the ground and I fill the hole, see what I did. It's great. That's it. I mean, you see the physical
work. It doesn't work for me at all. Sorry, Bob. I mean, I'm kidding. A little bit. I just don't like to exert myself and sweat. I'm in Florida. Going outside doing yard work is like torture.
You can sweat sitting in on your sofa. The thing, too, I think is so important here is here's God resting on the Sabbath day because he has entered into his glory. This is not God's tired and so he's taken a break. God is finished. And so he is enjoying the wonderful work that he has, but he has entered into his Sabbath rest. What is the Sabbath rest? Not lying around. It's not just leisure as an end in itself. The Sabbath rest is enthronement. You know, the king is always, when he's at rest, again, going back to the ancient Near East, when he's at rest, he is enthroned. Now, what does he want Adam and Eve to do? Give up their working of the 6 days in imitation of him, hold up empty hands, and walk into the Sabbath day to receive his benediction, to be glorified as his royal image bearers. And if Adam, as the covenant head, had succeeded in crossing that finish line, entering into God's rest, imitating God, even to the point of completing everything God had given him to do, to make the whole earth the kingdom of the Lord, if he had accomplished that, then he and all of his posterity, including us, would have then and there been glorified. We're awaiting glorification now because, you know, things got off track. Adam and Eve and all of us would immediately have been glorified. That's the Sabbath, deification, that we would be made as much like God as it's possible for a creature to be. And so when we're called to the Sabbath, we're called to enter into the presence of God, the God of grace who wants to give us. And I think the biggest thing about the Sabbath and why we should keep it holy amid secular days, since after the fall, the cult and culture are distinguished. This is the holy day. What are we to do on it? We're not to do on it. That's the point. We're to rest in the gift and the giftedness, not only of redemption, but of creation itself. Just to sit in that little throne next to God, anticipating that day when we will be glorified too.
But there was a fall.
I mean, there was that.
I mean, I love this because you're talking about covenant of works and Adam's faithfulness and what it could have been like in this beautiful picture. But there's a fall, and you have Genesis 3, specifically 17 through 19, which looks like how God describes how the nature of work would change post-fall. The fall made work a burden. Let me read Genesis 3, 17 and 18 and parts of 19. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat of the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. We also know that there's going to be pain in childbirth. So it sounds like both the multiplying and having dominion are frustrated by the fall. So what do we want to say about how the fall has influenced or shaped or distorted or made work a burden? This is where many people start with work.
Yeah.
So how do we reflect on that?
Yeah, as I'm just sort of thinking about it, you know, two quick points is that to sort of summarize what you've already said in a sense is that work itself is cursed. It's harder. It's seen as toil and not gift. But then also the trajectory of our work is bent towards ourselves as opposed to others. Good. And we mentioned that the ground will be, you know, harder to till, you know, even giving birth, you know, sweat of our brow and these sorts of things. And I think Genesis 11 really bears this out with the Tower of Babel. I think that's a very helpful way to demonstrate that they were working hard in this field, in this plain of the land of Shinar, but they said, let's build this temple basically to make much of ourselves. Come, let us build bricks. Let's burn them thoroughly. Why? So that everyone will know who we are. Everyone will see that tower that's touching the heavens.
Our name will be remembered.
Exactly. So they were using the very hands that God had given them to glorify himself for the glory of their own name. That's the tragedy of work as well, post-fall. Our motivation for doing it is just completely spoiled if we don't try to put it under the submission and lordship of Christ.
It's interesting to know, Luther, if I could bring in a little bit of Luther here, when he talks about vocation, he talks about our vocations taking place within three estates or three institutes. And before the fall, you have the institution of the church where God speaks to his people. Then you have the institution of the family. And we could also say sort of, you might say the workplace here as well as that family expands out. And those things are very good. But with the fall, we see that Adam now blames God and there's a break. As you were saying earlier, the cult is kind of distorted now. We see division between Adam and Eve, and Adam and Eve and the serpent and the ground and all of this. So now a third estate has to be established. Now, just so we're clear, the first two estates still exist, but they're distorted. They're broken. There's hardship. There's sin. There's pain. There's thorns and thistles. So now a third estate has to be established, and that, I always like to think of this, is the government, which is a result of sin. I'll leave that there for a second. But actually, it's a good thing. We need to have somebody in charge. We need to have laws established to keep order, because if there's not order, if there's not somebody rewarding good and punishing bad, then sinners are just going to run amok and it's going to become Sodom and Gomorrah, or it's going to become the Tower of Babel everywhere. And so God has to have in place an institute, an estate. I'm trying to think of a better word to use than those, but that's what's coming
armed
to mind.
Armed with a sword.
Yeah, to keep things in order.
You know, here another distinction, common grace and common curse. You know, now after the fall, you need grace. Before, God made us in his image. We weren't sinners. We were naturally capable of obeying him and entering into his rest, fulfilling the commission that he'd given us. But after the fall, obviously, we can't. And that's not only unbelievers. It means Adam and Eve and their kids, not just Cain, but Abel and Seth later. There's a common curse. So now, here's where common grace starts. Common grace starts with God not letting us back to the tree of life. I mean, it starts with God closing down the Garden of Eden, saying condemned. The angel he sends to guard with flashing sword. That already is God's grace. That's God's common grace, because if Adam and Eve, as curious as they are, as disobedient as they are, they want to be autonomous. They want to be God themselves. They're going to go to that tree of life. They've already eaten from the one tree he said, don't eat from. Now they're going to go to that tree, the tree of life. And if they eat from that tree, they and their posterity will be confirmed in everlasting damnation forever. And so God ends the unity of cult and culture at that moment. God says, now east of Eden, you're going to get out of the holy, because right now, I'm telling you right now, you're on my property. This is holy land. Hmm. This was meant to be the capital, the base for holiness spreading out to the world. Now you're unholy, you're corrupt. Anything corrupt in my temple gets burned. I don't allow anything corrupt. Nothing corrupt shall enter it. So I've got to excommunicate you. But instead, I'm going to give you this promise, but you can't live in the holy land or you'll be turned to ash. Now, east of Eden, that's where we live, that's where we work, that's where our work takes place, but it's still under the common grace of God. So what that means is, because of creation and common grace, there isn't a Christian plumbing and a Christian art and a Christian nation. It's all common, but it's under God's common grace as well as a common curse. So it can't be as bad as it would be if we hadn't fallen because of common grace, but it can't be as good as we'd like it to be. And here's the thing, Christians and non-Christians alike are under common grace and common curse. So Christians aren't made smarter than non-Christians as engineers or as scientists or whatever. Regeneration doesn't give us a new science. God's grace and our sinfulness are things that all human beings share.
C.S. Lewis says, boiling an egg is the same process whether you are a Christian or a pagan.
Let's run with this. Let's explore this. How does a biblical framework help us navigate these distorted ways of thinking about work? How does this apply to ourselves and to our friends and family members? And I'll go first on this. I both putting what you said, Walter, about how in the fall, work is curved inward toward us, taking that insight, which is very helpful, and what you said about Luther's three states. I want to put these together, you know, the church, the household, and the state. And these three estates order and structure all of human life, and Christians are called to and within those structures. And so thinking through common curse and common grace, what you said, Mike, doesn't separate those. There's not a slice of that isn't common grace and then the rest are for curse. It doesn't divide those up. And so this curved inward, the insight from the common grace thing is from Luther is that we all already have a calling. We have this tendency to spiritualize or secularize the language of calling. The fall distorts it. So here's the quote from Luther, which I think and hope would be helpful. How is it possible, and this is him talking about the three states that you brought up, Bob, how is it possible that you are not called? You've always been in some state or station. You've always been a husband or wife or boy or girl. Just the beauty of the simplicity of that, of the common grace and how that applies.
That's something you have to become.
Yeah, you are. And so there's always a part of the cultural mandate that you are involved in, that you are still fulfilling, even though there is a fall. And because we are God's adopted children, we take pleasure in the ways that we can fulfill it. There's joy. There can be joy in that work if we have, I believe, this biblical framework that you guys have been describing.
Oswald Bayer goes so far as to say is everybody, in a sense, by virtue of their creation, is born into the church. Now, he doesn't mean by, you know, to be a part of the church proper, but he does say everyone's a creature of God. You have a vocation as a creature. Now, false teaching, heresy, other religions, all of these things are a result of the fall and a distorted view of faith. But all of you are creatures of the one true God, whether you know it and believe it or not. And then you're all part of a family, and you all have responsibility to the community, and you have to take care of, like, all, you always have some vocational role. No one is without vocation.
That's why I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about the cultural mandate still being in place. And I think it's a real relief that the cultural mandate is not in place, that there is not this demand of the law, do this and you shall live. Hmm. And Adam and Eve have to fulfill that or they are excommunicated, they with all their posterity. But rather that God brings us into his rest by grace, not by our fulfilling the cultural mandate, but by Jesus fulfilling it. Jesus has come and he's fulfilled that mandate to rule and subdue. He is the prophet, priest, and king that we need. And now our work is based not on that covenant, but on the Noahic covenant. And our church and family life are based on the covenant of grace. The promise of Genesis 3:15, he'll crush the serpent's head. But our common life with non-Christians is based on the Noahic covenant. God made it to them as much as to us. He made it to my German shepherd. I swear to all of creation, I will never do this again. And every time I see the rainbow, the sacrament of this covenant in the sky, in the ancient Near East, that was a bow hung upside down, meaning at rest from war. He turned a meteorological phenomenon he created into a sacrament of his commitment. Whenever I see, not you see, it'll remind you. When I see it, it'll remind me not to wipe you off the map. And common grace, the Noahic covenant, opens up space for the fulfillment of Genesis 3:15, the coming of the Redeemer, who will be the true prophet, priest, and king. And if we are united to him, why are we called Christians? Heidelberg Catechism says, because we're anointed in Christ, the prophet, priest, and king.
So as we continue to kind of make this practical, as we're trying to figure out how does all this biblical, theological things that we're talking about come down to, to real life as we're working in our vocations, working in our communities, working in our churches, working in these various spheres that we do our vocation in. One of the things that I think about is that we identify with God in our labors in a real sense. Amy Sherman, in her book, Kingdom Calling, she talks about God has a redemptive work that he's doing. his saving, reconciling actions and activity. And those who are ministers of the gospel are mirroring that, are exercising that in some way. God has a creative work fashioning the physical world. Those who are sculptors and builders and designers and things like that, they're actually taking the world and fashioning sort of material things. God is a God of justice. He's one who is meticulous in that. And, you know, some of us have vocations, actual jobs, I should say, that really mirror that in many ways. I have children. So, you know, they come to me, well, he did this, she did this. I mean, so that I'm arbitrating at that point. And so, you know, there's a sense in which, you know, we are, even those little tiny actions, and as annoyed as I get when my kids continually come to me, well, he did this and she did that. And then there comes the one that they're talking about around the corner, defending themselves, you know, not caring about what the other is saying. But, and I have to, as a fallen creature, I have to sort of subside my frustration at the existence of the squabble. And then I need to respond as a just, loving, and fair sort of, you know, father, which we know that that has all kinds of sort of divine sort of implications. That so I'm standing in a real sense for the Lord. Am I able to be that sort of figure for even my children so that they can then have sort of an understanding of there is someone out there?
I love that. I feel that because
yeah.
You're describing all too frequent moments in my life where I come back from serving as a minister or a professor, and I will literally be sitting on the couch looking at an Atlanta Braves baseball game, and I'll hear a squabble, and I'll be annoyed because my calling is dad. I want that on my terms. I want that at the dinner table and when I'm praying at night. That's when I have a limited view of my calling as dad, and just that idea right there helps me tweak a specific dimension in my life that when I get back with my kids, I'm not going to hear the squabble and think this is an opportunity to actually kind of, you know, do my vocation in a healthy way.
Exactly.
That's God honoring and also hopefully reflects something to them of how the Father actually has a disposition toward them of grace and kindness and love and patience.
I think practically too, it helps so much practically to say, all right, work, common grace, common curse. Common grace, I'm working with non-Christians. The work that I'm doing has standards of excellence. How does it have standards of excellence? They're all totally depraved. They're wretches. I'm saved. I'm regenerate. I'm born again. No, no, no. How do we have these standards of excellence? Because they're still created in the image of God. We all share in this common grace, Christian and non-Christian alike. Why can't Christians create a good nation? I mean, even if we could have a majority of Christians running a nation, we've had that before and didn't work out very well. Common curse. Doesn't mean we're smarter, we're better at running things. We're working. We go to work with non-Christians, and that's meaningful. Why? Because we're all created in the image of God. God's common grace is at work, and we are loving and serving our neighbors. But then Sunday comes. The reason we don't work on the Lord's Day is because we are resting and receiving. This is the day we don't do, but we receive. A lot of times people go to church to get their marching orders for the week. People go to church to be told how busy they have to be. Then they go out on Monday, they have no food, they're supposed to do all this work without being fed. No, go to church, rest, receive all of God's saving grace so that on Monday, you can be part of the service God is rendering to your neighbors in common grace.
That's all the time we have for this episode of White Horse Inn. But you can continue the conversation with your own copy of Every Waking Hour by our guest for this series, Dr. Walter Strickland. In his book, Dr. Strickland helps us grasp a deeper and richer understanding of work as a vocation given to us by God Himself. Even though our work is affected by our own sin and the brokenness of a fallen world, our work can still be done to the glory of God and to the good of our neighbor. We can even take pleasure in our work. If you want to learn more, we'll send you this resource for a gift of any amount. Just go to whitehorseinn.org/offers. That's whitehorseinn.org/offers. Thanks, and be sure to join us next time on White Horse Inn. We'll be talking about how Christians engage their work differently than their non-Christian neighbors. That's next time on White Horse Inn.